Good afternoon. I'll call to order the meeting of the State Government Budget Division for Monday, January 29, 2007. Let the record reflect we do have a quorum. We're going to be going through the budget, the agency overviews of the budget. And today we have four councils here with us, and we'll go in order as they are listed on the agenda. Members, you can find the pertinent budget requests in the back of the towards the back of the budget books. If you look after the tab for each one, you'll see where they are. And we are going to be starting with the Council on Black Minnesotans. Mr. Collins, welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Lester Collins, the Executive Director of the State Council on Black Minnesotans, and actually my associate, Roger Banks, may very well join me for
go ahead.
Those things
sure.
That we forget, or that I forget. And number one, good afternoon to you all. And I would also like to acknowledge and thank those community folks that are here today to support us. So, thank you.
Do you have anything you want to tell us first before we get going, or I've got a few things I want to ask, but if you want to just kind of give none of the Budget Division members have been on this Budget Division in the recent past, so they may not be quite familiar with what the Council does. I see you've given us a copy of your biennial report. We do have a couple of other documents, but I think if you just kind of explained who you are and what you do, that'll at least give us an idea of what direction we need to go in for discussion.
Thank you. Yes, it's my pleasure to share with those members that are new and those that are a bit more familiar. The Council on Black Minnesotans, number one, was created in 1980. To the thanks of some of the individuals that are definitely here in this room, including the legislature itself, that kind of recognized the need and the continuing need to have some type of liaison or body that worked between what might be community-related statewide concerns and those dealing with public policy. While we are a state agency, we work at a number of different levels. It's almost impossible, at least based on our experience, to deal with just state legislature or legislation without dealing with city, county, and those other areas. So while our specific duties and responsibilities are certainly here and its impact or legislative impact in terms of public policy, we work at those other levels, including judiciary and other areas, and we do those in conjunction, you know, with our community. One of the primary responsibilities, at least as I view them and they change, is the monitoring of legislation and its impact on African and African-American individuals. Having spoken of or mentioned African individuals, one of our charge and responsibilities is also to work as a liaison with and for that community. To that end, I mentioned the council was created in 1980. Two of the chairs of the Council on Black Minnesotans boards have been individuals of what might be Native African descent. I believe one from Nigeria, and Mr. Tyretta, who sits in the front here, from Ethiopia, if I'm not mistaken, who served us very well and continues to do so. This is a side commercial break. Tyretta also works in the council's office now after having served on the council some years ago, at least 4 or 5 years ago, maybe. He works as a senior volunteer. No, he's not a volunteer. He's paid as a part of a quality career development kind of service. So he works in the office. Among the many concerns, I guess, that we address and concern ourselves with are certainly in the area of economic development, education, housing, clearly across the board. I wish we had the luxury And I could sit here and say to you that these three things are the primary things that we actually do. Unfortunately, we don't feel like we have that luxury. So our concerns pretty much encompass areas of child welfare. In fact, the chair of the African American Adoption Agency, which was about a 20-year effort with the help of the council, is here present with her. Her name is Marquita Stevens, with her husband, Reverend Stevens. And that effort came out of the council's initiatives and concerns. And there is a African-American Adoption Agency, which, by the way, serves more than the concerns of only African-American children, but it is one of its principal responsibilities. I happen to be the chair of that committee at this particular point, and have been, I guess, almost since its inception, and it's as old as 8 years old at this particular point. Talking really quickly, fast, I mean, issues as outlined in our biannual report of health, civic engagement, all those kinds of things. This place, this building, both the state office building and the Capitol, where decisions are made as it relates to public policy, are unfortunately yet still places that our community is not as involved or doesn't feel as comfortably involved in it, you know, as it should be. And it's our continued efforts with our community partners to have greater involvement, both with you and especially with the policies and practices that are decided upon in these places of decision. So we've had a number of activities over the years. We used to call it African American Lobby Day. And as any of you well know, the council really technically does not lobby. It is in an advisory capacity, and I guess that's one thing I should clarify. We clearly work as in an advisory capacity to the governor, to the legislature, to commissioners, and others, and we have varying relationships with those individuals, probably most closely with the Department of Human Services, Corrections, and other departments, but certainly through our constituent connections, et cetera. The Urban Leagues, the NAACPs, et cetera. We try to work so that we can ultimately make for a better Minnesota. We do believe that improving the conditions of both the African and African American community in conjunction with our other council members ultimately makes a stronger Minnesota. The thing that I will spare you is, unfortunately, the African American community at this particular point still and continues to be probably among, you know, the highest in terms of the disparate areas, almost in terms of health, education, all of these areas. And we as a staff, along with the community, pretty much are as stretched as we possibly can be in terms of our advisory capacity and also our research capacity in terms of trying to aid not only in terms of the identification of problems that we have, but also, more importantly, solutions. Having mentioned that, not only do we monitor legislation, but the council in its existence has probably proposed and successfully had at least 70-something pieces of legislation passed. One of those, the more controversial issues, was what was called by a number of different names, the Minority Family Preservation Act, which dealt with the placement of African-American children within their family systems. Unfortunately, that issue has always been dealt with as a black-white issue. And I've tried to make clear in my involvement and along with others that it really is a family issue, that we are capable of taking care of our children. And in instances where we can't, there are family members and others. There was a point, and we have a report that's probably 200 pages long that we did, I'm guessing, some 15 years ago, dealing with placement, kinship, personnel development, any number of other issues where African-American children clearly were not being placed within their family systems in what we call stranger-based homes, or where they were placed. Mr. Chair, if I could, and it just occurred to me as I was talking about adoption and children, I also want to recognize, and I think it's appropriate, our other chair of our board is Diane Benz, who sits in the kind of salmon-looking color that's also present and has served the council very well. So I could go on, and there are other things I'm sure that Roger could and will perhaps speak to, but I'll end it on that note.
Senator Cobley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Mr. Collins? Or
It is.
Mr. Collins.
Okay, thank you. I guess you're covering a lot of ground here pretty quickly. You made a comment about the resources of your office were stretched. Are you saying that your staffing is insufficient to meet the demands of the office, or, you know, can you say a little more about that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, absolutely. And it has been. And while I certainly, and I can speak for Roger as well, love what we do, we have a statewide responsibility. We've been to, Wilmer, St. Cloud. We go to Mankato. We try to get to, the growing population of African Americans, Africans within the state. But clearly, on any given day, and especially those folks that sit to my left, know that we are more than stretched, in terms of our advisory involvement, research capacity. Clearly, yes.
So, well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Collins, are you constrained to not seek anything additional for your efforts?
Mr. Chair, Senator, thank you for the question. We do. And in fact, let me give you a specific instance. We are in process and pretty much complete with a Blue Cross Blue Shield contract that we have sought, and we were involved with what was Impact, and I'm sure most folk in this room are fairly familiar with that effort. We just completed, I think it was a three-year grant with them dealing with cessation in terms of smoking, education, et cetera. Having ended that, we successfully were able with the community to obtain and to enter into a contract position, I guess you would say, with Blue Cross Blue Shield dealing with cessation and smoking. That will aid. We will hire actually an individual who will be a state employee for the duration of that grant. And it's been similar kinds of activities or efforts in that particular regard that we have sought. Mr. Chair, if I could, just extending, just a bit, another responsibility we have is the Martin Luther King statewide celebration, which we've done, I'm guessing, at least 12 to 15 years now. We also raise funds for this effort, if you will, and we're not satisfied that the celebration as it stands is primarily a day celebration. We believe that there are other efforts and education involvement, et cetera, that we could definitely have on the table and have proposed to this body that would be year-round. But again, even these efforts in terms of raising funds are not easy. But in answer to your question, we do seek other sources by way of grants, collaborations, et cetera, in terms of extending and strengthening our efforts.
Mr. Collins, I've got a couple of questions. You just mentioned the Minnesota Partnership for Action Against Tobacco. We've got a copy of the legislative auditor's report from about a year ago, and they said that that partnership had provided you, your agents, your council, with about $72,000. They give you a grant with the agreement that you'd provide $72,000 of in-kind contributions, and it wasn't clear that in-kind contributions were ever reported. Has that been taken care of?
Yes, it's been at least satisfied both with the partnership, and I would say we're still in conversations with our budget officer who is present, Peggy, is it Eagleson? Lexall, who is present, with us. I would say that we probably, erred in the sense that there's no doubt that we provided $72,000 in in-kind contributions in terms of staff time, et cetera. Our documentation of those efforts, and we developed and created that budget or proposal in conjunction with the community. And in fact, in our board hearings and addressing this issue, it's pretty much acknowledged that I think we were, if you will, a bit overly ambitious in terms of identifying in-kind contributions. NPAT did not require, and they're still not asking us to essentially verify that. Having said that, we have developed with this new grant, there is no in-kind contribution per se, but we do have the documentation and the kinds of things we need to be able to document indeed what our in-kind contributions to that contract or effort in terms of what it is. So.
And has that information then been provided to the legislative auditor that you have the documentation?
It has. In fact, I brought a copy which was submitted to our financial management people, which submitted it to the legislative auditor. I believe that we have spoken to and essentially satisfied that particular concern. And even more importantly, as we move forward, so that we don't repeat essentially anything related to that kind of concern.
Okay, members, you also do have a copy of the auditor's report if you want to look at that. Mr. Collins, the auditor's report also said that the council received a $60,000 grant from the Department of Children, Families, and Learning that was not used and had to be returned to what is now the Department of Education. Have those funds been returned now?
Mr. Chair, the funds were not returned.
Okay.
They were indeed used, but we have received satisfactory fulfillment or verification from the Department of Education for having extended, worked out, given, having granted $60,000 essentially to community partners, which we certainly knew that we had done. At the time that the audit was done, one of the employees that worked specifically in that area was no longer an employee. It took some time to gather and essentially put together a report to verify essentially what we already knew. And I have received from the department satisfaction from them as relates to the grant, its administration, its use of funds, et cetera. And essentially, there is no money owed, or to be given to the department, and they're quite satisfied that we carried out and rendered the funds. Not to overly, speak to this area, the one thing that was found is that there was no doubt, at least on our end, that those funds had been, given to the community, and one of the controversies had to do with whether we had essentially assigned or given this money out after the contract period. I think we've satisfied or at least shown that there was indication from the department that that contract would be extended and that we were working very much in good faith in terms of our efforts. But the most important thing is that the department is more than satisfied that we carried out contractually our duties and responsibilities as it relates to that particular contract.
And has that information been provided to the legislative auditor as well?
Absolutely.
Okay. I think the auditor also found that there were per diem payments that were made. Some of the time when leave sheets did not correspond with the amounts paid out, there were people paid twice for the same day. People who were not eligible to receive per diem were paid. Has that money, the OPA payment, been pursued?
Mr. Chair, everything, I think there were five members that were essentially identified. Three of those members have paid back the per diems. I think on one case is like $165, another one maybe $300 and something. I think the largest sum was $625 or $50 that was owed. For Mr. Chair, for those members who are less familiar with that particular situation, one of the things that was going on at that particular time, I think it was the Barber Board or someone was contesting essentially whether state employees during off time, on their own time, essentially serving on state boards, could they not receive per diems or be paid mileage and per diems. It was, as you all probably well know, decided at a later date that indeed they could receive per diems and mileage reimbursement. What we did is, having read and being aware of that situation, we contacted the Attorney General and asked for their advice. That apparently we have members who work for the state college system or for the university or someone. What should we do at this particular point? We were told that you should cease and desist any payment further to those members. And I have members who served for at least 8 months to 12 months additionally without compensation. The council was under the, we believe that by ceasing for that period of time and for what we had paid members who worked for the state system, and keep in mind, again, we're talking $165, $375, $600 and something, that indeed, once a decision was made that they could receive compensation, we were under the impression and essentially advised that it more than offset what they owed. We were sensitized that no, because the period of decision in terms of them being compensated came afterwards, it is your responsibility to obtain those dollars and satisfy that. If indeed they are to be reimbursed, that is a completely different matter. To answer your question specifically, at this particular point, three of five members have compensated the state back for the dollars that they were paid. One is negotiated or is in negotiation in terms of the amount, in terms of payback as it relates to tax ramifications, et cetera. And one member was arguing that, in fact, because they work for the state system or the university, that they didn't, in other words, they had some problem with what we were stating. We have since gotten the Attorney General's opinion and some other opinions probably about 2 weeks ago, and we will pursue or at least attempt to pursue the reimbursement of those amounts. And there is still the one outstanding situation that is essentially a proposal on the table to where the $650 owed, they want to, are proposing to pay a portion of that, and that matter has not been decided upon at this particular point.
And have you informed the legislative auditor about your collection results?
Absolutely.
Okay. I think they also found that your council was entering into contracts that you may not have had the amount the funds to pay for, and which exceeded the guidelines of the Department of Administration. Has that issue been remedied?
Mr. Chair, yes. And that particular contract had to do with Gangelhoff Auditorium, which is Concordia University. We, as I have indicated, have used that particular site, I think, nearly 12 to 15 years at this particular point. And in the particular year that cited, their expenses were over a $5,000 amount. We did not, catch or were not cognizant of the whole idea that we had indeed gone over the amount that we had encumbered. I think that there were other expenditures that we incurred with them that we hadn't forecasted. But we have since just paid closer attention. In fact, we just used Concordia again. I think the amount was $4,900 and something dollars. And it had principally been that kind of amount in the previous year. So, yes, we have satisfied or very much aware that funds need to be encumbered, a contract needs to be entered into before, incurring those kind of expenses. We hadn't anticipated it, but indeed it was greater than it had been in the previous 10 or 11, 12 years that we had been dealing with that organization.
I'm looking, members, page 5 of the summary in our budget books, page 5 of the Black Minnesota Council. And, Mr. Collins, I note that the governor's recommending as a change item, in fiscal year 2008, $40,000 for your council's operations. Fiscal year 2009, $41,000 for $81,000 in the biennial. I don't see a description as to, perhaps, could you describe what it is that this money is going to be used for? The $81,000 in addition. And that on page 6, it looks like there's a more detailed description. What do you, it says to enable the council to better address the issues facing the Black community and to fund the state's annual Martin Luther King celebration. Could you describe in greater detail what the $81,000 is going to be used for?
Sure. Mr. Chair, and I should mention, I don't have that, unfortunately, in front of me. I don't have what you have. I certainly justifier spoke to or what you have is what I wrote as a request to the governor's office. Essentially, and to try to be as succinct as I possibly can, clearly in terms of additional staff, at present we are at three individuals, you know, in terms of the council staff. We reduced our staff composition, if you will, to 3.5 individuals at one point. We are at 3 individuals at this particular point. Roger, you're at 80%. You're at 80%. 80%. Yeah, you're at 80% at this particular point. And certainly, one thing I should point out is that myself and particularly Roger, we work easily any Saturday, Sunday, on almost every 52 weeks of the year. And I would like to essentially compensate him to the degree that he is putting time and effort along with staff. So it is staffing dollars. It is also hopefully to be able to fully fund the position, which I don't have filled at this particular point because we need that function. And I'm believing, and Peggy perhaps, I don't know if I can, in terms of her aid, but we are additionally looking for the additional King funding that is needed. We essentially, it takes about $38,000 to $40,000 to put this event on. Up until this particular time, at least the last several years, the amount from the state has been about $10,000, $11,000, and we have raised the additional funds to put this event on. But it essentially is for staffing, composition, and for other administrative duties and responsibilities that we essentially have.
Let me ask you about possible technology or computer requests. For the benefit of the members of the Budget Division, the book that we have before us are the governor's recommendations for the operations, the funding, the staff. There is a separate submission for technology because since everybody's asking for it, rather than have agency by agency, there's just a separate document that deals with it. And as we deal with the agencies, we'll provide to you the request as it pertains to that agency. Mr. Collins, it does not appear there is a request for technology or computers for your council. Is that where you're at?
Mr. Chair, I'm glad you asked that question. I'm going to, if I can, refer to Mr. Banks and allow him to maybe speak to that question.
And again, the separate documents I'm referring to or the governor's recommendation, so I don't know whether he just didn't recommend it for your council, whether you need it or want it. I don't know because we have to make some decisions soon. But Mr. Banks, please identify yourself for the record.
Yeah, Roger Banks. I'm the research analyst for the Council on Black Minnesotans. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and senators. We had initially submitted or generated a request for technology. But unfortunately, the particular format that was developed by the governor and that are generally used by the larger agencies was really not appropriate for our size agency. We have, I would say, minimal costs associated with technology. We have a web page that needs to be maintained. We have some equipment that may need to be replaced, but in reality, it's somewhere around, I would say, less than $100,000 a year for that particular endeavor. We attempted to submit the report, but it was an incomplete report because many of the questions that were asked in that particular format were just not appropriate. We've got 7 computers in our agency, along with 2 servers, one of which is not working appropriately, and most of the work has been transformed or transmitted over to the second server. But for the most part, We don't have that much cost. The major thing has to do with the maintenance, both of the machines and the equipment and the web page that we now have on site.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could, there is no doubt that our intention also was to put in a request. In fact, I believe that we were also working on our biennial report at the same time that technological request was being made. There's no doubt that our needs are similar or much the same as the other councils in that particular regard. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I would believe that we are probably less technologically equipped than our counterparts, and that's not their needs are as great or as they have stated them. But we definitely have a need. We just, I think, given manpower, et cetera, the only reason why you don't have a request in front of you is for those limitations, not because the need does not exist.
I suspect the governor's office may be submitting a supplemental budget proposal after the February forecast comes out, and it's impossible for us to guess agency needs unless we have something before us. We can't do everything, but if you don't ask, you don't get around here. So
yes, we will, Mr. Chair, get something, you know, essentially to the governor, to you in that particular regard. As I stated, the need very much is there. In fact, most of the time, in terms of our operational TA needs, we're going, you know, without or delays in terms of our system. So the need is definitely there.
Are there any questions from the committee members on the requests or issues that we've talked about from the council on Black Minnesotans? Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, this is more of a, when we were presented the governor's proposal about having that department that would kind of oversee the smaller departments, would this be something that would help some of these departments we're going to be seeing today? You know, where you talked about support staff and just kind of overseeing the operations of smaller departments?
I don't know. Anybody can respond to that? We will be having, maybe as time goes on, we'll have other people in here, can keep the question. Is somebody here? Okay. Why don't you come on forward and identify yourself for the record. Come on.
Mr. Chair, my name is Peggy Lexo. I'm with the Department of Finance, and I'm the budget officer for the councils here today. The question you raised is a very good one. The reason that we were not requesting the councils to be included in that is that they already, for three of the councils, already receive that assistance right now from admin. So that's in statute, the Department of Administration provides financial management and human resources help to
which
to,
three?
It's the Council on Black Minnesotans, okay. The Asian Pacific Council, and the Chicano Latino Council.
So Indian Affairs Council is not.
Not at this time.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions, Senator Olsen?
I did, and it was on page 24 of your report. Of your report, maybe it wasn't 24. 26. You listed under priorities, the second one was, I was struck in with particular focus on racial profiling and police misconduct. And you had addressed that the priorities haven't changed much over the years. Are you making any headway in racial profiling, or what are your feelings on what's happening with that?
I'm going to allow Mr. Banks to speak to that issue, and I wish, but it's not appropriate, that I could have some of our community members speak to it who work specifically with us in this particular regard. But Mr. Banks will speak
to it. And I don't know that we can get too much in depth on some of those issues because this is a budget division and we do have three other councils to go through today. But go ahead, Mr.
Right. As all of you are aware, there was an enactment passed in 2001 called the Racial Profiling Act. We were very much involved in that particular process. It mandated a survey to be conducted. Since that point in time, there has been a hearing, I believe it was 2 years ago, in the Joint Committee of Senator Foley and Senator Ranum's committee in the Senate. There are three major components to that particular bill. One had to do with mandating the survey. The other three had to do with developing a model policy, a model curriculum, and then the creation of a 1-800 number for statewide complaints regarding police misconduct. Yes, we are still very much involved in working in this particular area. In fact, we are trying to arrange in the House and Representative Mullery's committee to have a much similar kind of hearing that occurred in the Senate 2 years ago. We want to check with some of the representatives and the senators who have proposed legislation, like, for example, 2 years ago, Senator Scott Dibble and Senator Mimua submitted some legislation that I have asked them to clarify as to whether or not they're going to reintroduce that this year. But we are laying the foundation for that kind of activity, trying to educate the House members relative to the outcomes and the results of the survey, and also to get them some information on the other three components, because those three components have not been reported on. They weren't reported on to the Senate, and they have been reported on in the House. So, yes, we are diligently working in that particular area. We're also working with the Minneapolis Police Department relative to the mediation process and the police misconduct issue and the out-of-home placement issue associated with mediation in Minneapolis.
Sir Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see that your priority in the 2006 was education issues.
Yes.
And I'm really pleased to see that up there. And I don't know, is that still your top priority for 2007?
Yes.
Because I just think that education brings us all up. And a lot of these other issues are going to could kind of melt away if education becomes the main priority. And I'm really glad to see that that is your focus. And I, you know, there's something that I really feel that you could help with, and that is to help families in the Black communities place more value on education. And I it's something that's really hard as a state government to do, but I think a council like yours could have much greater impact. And I don't know if you've addressed that issue particularly or not, mm-hmm. but I'm just wondering if that's something you're giving consideration to.
Mr. Thanks. Chair, Senator, yes, we are very much aware of this. In fact, just Saturday before last, we had a meeting that dealt with the African-American Leadership Council of St. Paul, where the superintendent of schools in St. Paul had identified 100 male youth who were at risk of not graduating. We have since set up a mentorship program for those kids so that they can become involved and have their parents. It was a joint meeting for parents and youth. And we had a fairly decent turnout, and individuals expressed a lot of interest in this particular area. In addition to that, there are other entities that are very much have the same orientation as you are, or the same concerns. And that has to, one of them is the St. Paul Ramsey County Children's Initiative. They have X number of dollars available for local collaborative time study allocation. And this year, I think they are going to be focusing more on populations of color and American Indians, because those are the ones who are experiencing the greatest disparities in education in particular.
Mr. Chair, not too long, but you also even noticed that the King Celebration Education was the theme and will continue to be. And again, with any number of our partners, the African American Leadership Council and others, we continue to work in these areas. There are a number of barriers. You just mentioned in terms of encouraging African American families and I should say African families in terms of valuing education. I think they do. I think what we have seen in many cases, they are discouraged and To be honest with you, similar to this building, too often they are intimidated. It's not a place where parents are feeling comfortable. We're working on those areas with the superintendent, particularly of St. Paul, and with other organizations. There is much that we still need to do, but it remains a definite priority with us and with our partners.
Mm-hmm. Pardon me. And if you're all, you might be available on Tuesday at 7 o'clock in the evening. There is a house hearing, K-12 house hearing at the Minneapolis Urban League, in case you would like to get some input relative to some of the educational issues facing the African-American and African communities.
So that's any further questions on this council? Well, Mr. Collins, thank you for coming, and we will, as I said, be preparing the budget over the next couple of weeks. So if there's any supplemental information you need to get to us, please feel free to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.
And community.
Thank you. Next, the next tab you have, members, is the Council on Chicano Latino People. And Mr. Munoz, welcome to the budget committee. There's also a copy of their biennial report that you should have.
Kathleen, do I just turn this on?
Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Rogelio Munoz, and I'm the Executive Director for the Chicano Latino Affairs Council.
Go ahead.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the Senate Committee. On behalf of the Chicano Latino Affairs Council Board and staff, I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to present to you today and for the invitation to comment on the governor's recommendations and also to inform you of some of the past activities that the Chicano Latino Affairs Council has undertaken in the past biennium and the strategic objectives that we have for the next biennium. Now, being my first time in doing this, I didn't know which format to do it, and I thought it would be best to provide a visual overview of the council and just to easier facilitate today's presentation. And I don't want to comment on all of the responsibilities and duties of the council, but in 1978, the Minnesota legislature established the council by statute 3.9223 with the primary mission to advise the governor and the members of the state legislature on issues that are important to the Latino community and find ways in which we can transform public policy to improve the conditions that Latinos were living in those days and today. I've highlighted a couple of them, and I just commented on the first one. I'll comment on the fourth one, and we serve as a conduit or as a bridge to state government for organizations that work with Latino community, with the Latino community. The other bullet that I'd like to highlight is the one that we is the bullet or is the duty and responsibility in which the council works very hard with, and that's to serve as a referral agency. Because we're a very small agency, we don't provide too many services, and the only service that we do provide with our limited capacity is to serve as a referral agency to the Latino community so that they can garner some of the resources that are provided by state government and local resources and nonprofit organizations. The seventh bullet, as you can see there, is a very strong duty that the legislature gives to the council, and that's the authority to perform a contract contract for the performance of studies design. So initially what we do with this duty and responsibility is contract with organizations that research and do work with specific communities. Most recently, the council contracted with the Center for Rural Policy and Development. And that contract was a comprehensive study on Latino students in our public schools. It was a very, very positive assessment, and it gave us a closer look as far as how our Latino students are doing in public schools. And I can comment further in the presentation on that report. And then lastly, to publicize the accomplishments of our Chicano Latino members in Minnesota, I think oftentimes people are not recognized for their work and their contributions. And specifically, I think that it's very important in these days where we live in by party lines or whatnot and engage in partisan politics that we publicize the accomplishments of our Latino people members to Minnesota. Here's an organizational chart of our council. Very simple. I won't comment too much on it. Board of Directors, we have 15 members, 4 from the state legislature, 2 senators, and 2 representatives. At the council, we have 4 units. I'm not sure if you can see that, but it's on your slides. We have an administrative unit, as you can see, and that unit works with our finance committee of the board. And we have 3 other units, the community affairs unit, which does extensive work in rural and greater Minnesota and the metro area. And then we have a research analysis unit, which is led by our management analyst at the council. And then we have an internship program unit in which we have signed a memorandum of understanding with the University of Minnesota's Chicano Studies Department. Now, as you can see there, we have 2 vacant positions, the community liaison and the management analyst. So currently right now we have a 2 staff member council. Most recently, we had a community liaison who left the council in November, so that position is open. And with the governor's new recommendations for the budget for the next biennium, that will allow us to fill those 2 positions. So in the very near future, we will have a 4 staff office council.
And is that the governor's recommending $31,000 in 08 and 09? Is that what that's intended for?
Mr. Chair, the governor is recommending an additional $31,000 for the next fiscal year of 2008 and 2009, and that will allow us to fill another position, the fourth position.
I see. Okay, thank you. Oh, and a question on the legislature appoints the members of your that serve on your board, right? I mean, you have to wait till somebody's the legislature is going to fill those appointees, right, to your board.
Mr. Chair, the governor appoints 4 members of the legislature, 2 are senators and 2 are state representatives.
Oh,
yes.
The governor makes those appointments. Okay.
The legislature makes the appointments for the state representatives and the state senators.
Right. Yes. So the legislator appointees are your current ones are from the Senate, Senator Rosen, and they have been Senator Dean Johnson, so that certainly one will change if not. We'll just have to see, but okay. The appointments will be made at some time in the future, I think. So, okay.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I may continue, the next slide that you see there is Minnesota's Latino makeup of the state. And as you can see, those are clusters around the state. And from the 1990 census to the 2000 census, Minnesota saw one of the highest growing Latino community growth rates. And that was 166% increase of the population. So that went from 54,000 to about maybe 54,000 to 143,000, and that was a very huge increase. Today, the state demographer estimates that the Latino makeup of the state of Minnesota is around maybe 4%, which equates to 182,000. So as you can see, most of the Latino makeup is in the metro area of the Twin Cities. And then most recently, communities in south central Minnesota have seen an increase in Latinos in their communities. So that's another issue that I'd like to highlight. And then the makeup of the Latino community in Minnesota, as you can see in the pie chart, is more than half is Mexican, followed by Puerto Rican, and then Central American, as you can see.
It is very difficult to read this graph, though. I can't see the numbers very well. So.
Mr. Chair, I apologize
for that. Oh, it's in the
book?
Okay, I'm sorry. What page are you on?
Page 11.
Page 11, okay. Mm-hmm. I can see it. You don't have mature eyes like I do. So.
They're going fast.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, I see. Okay. Page 11. 10, 11. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, the circles depict the clusters throughout the state that have large minority or large populations of Latinos.
But, Mr. Chair?
Senator Roblin.
This was based on the 2000 census, this information on here?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes.
Thank you. Because, Mr. Chair, I represent Shakopee, and Chaska's right next door, And I know that the Latino population has increased dramatically in those two communities, and I don't even see them as on here yet.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think that that population is also represented in the Twin Cities metro area. So I'm assuming that that population in Shakopee is represented in the Minneapolis-St. Paul cluster of 77,000.
Okay, thank you.
Next is the agency overview of the governor's recommendations.
Oh,
and
sorry, Senator.
I'm sorry. On that reference to demographic growth of Latino communities throughout the state of Minnesota, what I think some of us have noticed is that Latino communities can impact a community rather fast. And the growth is much faster and greater than other people groups that come into an area. What motivates a large population of individuals to come into, let's say, a isolated community, and all of a sudden, you know, in 4 years, where there was none, now there's suddenly a lot of people. What causes that population increase so fast?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe I would have to answer the American dream. And I would say that in my travels throughout the state of Minnesota, especially most recently in Worthington, where we saw an issue, and I won't comment on the issue, but having speak with the people there, there's just so much opportunities for Latinos in areas or in industries where a common citizen would not engage in working in those settings. So I would say that there's a lot of gaps in some of these communities where Latinos have come in to not replace, but to fill the gaps and make communities move forward.
Mr. Chair, it's always been kind of interesting when I study demographics. I always kind of wonder why some people groups recognize that call to an American dream where others don't. And I'm wondering what's the deeper recognition by just one group seeing the potential of a dream to be fulfilled and no one else sees it. And maybe that requires more study than what this committee can offer at this point.
Well, Senator Limmer, it could be unrelated factors, too. In my area, in Fridley, there is a considerable growth of Muslim families, and that's because about five blocks away from where I live is a Islamic school. And so families are moving in so they can be closer to their school. You know, it may – that's just where they decided to go to, and it's perfectly reasonable. So it could be a number of factors, so. Okay. Anything further, Mr.
Mr. Chair and Senator, in addition to your comment, what we have seen is that, and I've spoken to the Commissioner of Agriculture with Gene Hugoson about this quite a bit, and the state of Minnesota is not the state of Minnesota that it used to be back in the 70s, where its agricultural industry was once ran by a seasonal part. You know, Minnesota would have the harvest from the spring throughout the fall, and then that was it. In the past, or most recently, Minnesota has now engaged and has become very competitive with other states such as Texas and California in agriculture, because now it is a year-long sort of industry where it has meat packing plants and all of that industry in the south central part of Minnesota. So I would say that there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of gaps that are being filled by Latinos in the state, where I would say again that the common citizen would not want to be in and sort of working conditions that they would not want to be in. Moving on to the agency overview, I've highlighted the governor's recommendations in two yellow columns. And I want to make note that the current appropriation of which the council has is 271, and this can be found again on your document that was submitted to you. Currently, we do have a 271 appropriation, and the governor has recommended a 13.7 increase in our appropriation for the next biennium, which would be 35,000 additional monies for the next fiscal year and 39,000 additional monies for the fiscal year of 2009. Now, I'd like to point to your direction on the expenditures by fund line, direct appropriations. There's a marginal difference between fiscal year 2006 and fiscal year 2007, and that is large and partly because the council did have two open vacancies. The executive director had not been filled for at least half a year, and a management analyst position had not been filled for 1 year, so for an entire year. So I want to make note that that's why we have an excess carryover from fiscal year 2006 to 2007.
Mr. Chairman?
Sarah Pappas.
Mr. Munoz, so you're relatively new. When did you start at the council?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, I started this past summer in June 2006.
Okay. So what was the issue with these positions not being filled?
The board, Mr. Chair, Senator, the board wanted to find a not make a very fast decision on who to appoint as executive director. So they had a statewide search for this position. And so rather than to appoint someone in a quickly time manner, that they would appoint someone with that they were sure of, mm-hmm. I would say.
And then, Mr. Chairman, and then they didn't want to fill the other positions until they had the executive director in place?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is correct.
Okay.
Okay. Go ahead.
The next slide, as you can see there, is the appropriation or the governor's recommendation again, which is a total of $306,000 for fiscal year 2008. And fiscal year 2009, that's $310,000 for that year. The change items, this is the sort of itemized, and I've sort of put them into two graphs, as you can see there. The first one, the governor is recommending to increase the budget for the Chicano Latino First Council by $31,000 for 2008 and, or for both fiscal years, to deal specifically with operations. So as I said, while we did have a carryover at the time of fiscal year 2005 and fiscal year 2006, the Chicano Latino First Council was dealing with a very slim budget constraint, and there was only three staff member council. So those numbers are reflected in the $271,000, where we only had three members in the council.
On the council of staff.
I thought that was my phone. Additionally, the other change item, as you can see there, Senators and Mr. Chair, is the compensation adjustment, which the governor has recommended $4,000 for the first fiscal year and $8,000 for the fiscal year of 2009. And those are just to sort of adding the inflationary factor for compensation adjustments. And then real quickly, if I can, I'd like to summarize some of the performance very briefly that the council has undertaken. As I once said, the council has the authority, or the state legislature gives the council the authority to contract with organizations who do research in the state. And most recently, we did an education report, or we contracted with for an education report, and that was entitled Latino Students in Our Public Schools. And that was just a comprehensive study to sort of recognize and acknowledge some of the problems and issues that afflict Latino students in our public schools. One of the good things that we found, and Senator, this will also make a comment on what we'll comment on your statement, was that Minnesota in the past 5 years saw a 3% decline in its classrooms. So a 3% downward trend in enrollment, while this report found that the Latino students in our public schools increased by 38%. Now, I'm not sure what it is. Perhaps it's a phenomenon on what is rising that number in our communities and in our schools. But we believe that was a very positive positive finding that we found in the report. However, we did find that the academic achievement with Latino students in our public schools is not so great. It's one of the minorities in the report that listed academic achievement or high academic achievement in the classroom. So that's something that we will engage in the next biennium, as well as the Black Council will. Education is one of our main focus areas. Other initiatives that we've had, literacy is very important in our community. We believe that we should do anything that we can in our statutory duty to empower our community through education. And we have partnered with Minnesota Department of Education through many initiatives with library and literacy workshops. Secondly, as you can see there on the third bullet, we hosted one of the first Latina congresswomen from the U.S. She's from California, and she represents the Congressional Hispanic Caucus Institute. It was a very happy moment for the council to have been a part of a scholarship signing between General Mills and the Congressional Hispanic Caucus Institute. General Mills donated $300,000 in scholarship monies for students, not only specifically from Minnesota, but on a national scale. So that was a very positive activity that the council was a part of. And then lastly, we've been involved with the Hispanic Association of Colleges and Universities. We've established scholarship resources for our students here in Minnesota, as well as we've taken part in many initiatives throughout the state with providing scholarship information, loan information, and admission information for Latino students to continue on their education into higher education. And then more activities that the council has engaged in, civic engagement, as you can see there. In 2005, we had what was called El Pueblo Hispano, and that was the state's only and all-encompassing Hispanic conference, which brought experts from all over the country and all over the state to address issues here in the state of Minnesota regarding Latino public affairs, in short. In 2006, we were very much involved with Latino voter registration. We believe that as our numbers are increasing in Minnesota, Latino communities are growing in Minnesota, we would like for them to take part in the democratic process. So one of our initiatives for 2008 is to engage in Latino voter registration. And we've been in very much contact with the Secretary of State, with Mark Ritchie, to engage in this and to increase our numbers of Latinos who are not registered, to have them registered for the 2008 elections.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Curious as it relates to that effort, if you've had any measurable way of knowing how many folks you have registered and what kind of effort the council has, what kinds of efforts you've used in this program.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's a very good question, and that's something that no one knows. And we're working with the Secretary of State, Mark Ritchie, and the state demographer to get those numbers, because it's a very important figure to know. And right now, the state of Minnesota does not have a number as far as how many Latinos we have registered in the state. But that's something that we're going to engage with in the next couple of years.
Mr. Chair, I guess the question was, did the council keep track in any way of how many people it was able to register? That was really the question. It sounds like you have public information campaign. In addition to that, was the voter registration effort one that allowed you to keep track of what sort of success you had with community members in registering, or was it just to get them the information for them to consider?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the initiative was to give them information. However, we don't have any numbers at this time as far as how many Latinos are registered in the state of Minnesota. And then lastly, as you can see there, community and media relations. The council's newsletter, statewide newsletter, had went into hiatus for the past 2 years, and so we reestablished that with a new name, and that is El Minnesotano, and that means it's translating to the new Minnesotan or the Latin Minnesotan. And that has been a very popular newsletter. We brought that back this past summer, and we're very proud to have that. And that's one of the ways that the council can engage in statewide with our communities, because again, we're a small staff council. These are one of the ways in which we can engage communities and inform communities that are in Worthington, communities that are in Moorhead, and communities that are in every corner of the state. And then lastly, our CLAC website, we're updating our website, making it more user-friendly. We have a Spanish edition or a Spanish version of the website, which is very friendly to our constituency. And then I forgot to mention our bilingual directory. That is sort of a Hispanic directory, or it's a statewide Hispanic directory, so that if anyone needs any services, whether they're state, local, or county, or federal, these resources will be in the bilingual directory for Latinos' use. And then this is just a quarterly. I'm sure you cannot see this, Mr. No. Chair, but this is sort of the makeup of the council's biennial strategic objectives, and we listed them by quarter. And the first quarter, you can't see this, but we're going to be engaged in the legislative process, the engagement. We're going to be engaged with the legislature, monitor legislation. The second quarter, we're going to prepare for our research in the summer and do community engagement. And then in the third quarter, we'll do research and advocacy and complete our research initiatives so that we can distribute them in October in the fall months and prepare for the next legislative session.
Mm-hmm. You may know something we don't know, but in May it says May 19 adjourn, and as I understand it, we can go until midnight May 21st. But maybe you know something. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, this information was provided by State Representative Al Junkie. So
maybe he's going to go home on the 19th, but some of us may still be here 2 days later. And also, we don't know when the next year's legislative session is going to start. But if you're preparing in November and December, maybe next January, you'll get a head start on us, I think. For elections, Minneapolis and St. Paul, I believe, has city elections this year. I don't know if any major elections are going on, so. Okay. Okay. Go on.
That is it.
Okay. Any questions of Ms. Munoz? And I think, as I asked to Council Black Minnesotans, the book that we got on computer requests, technology requests, I don't think had anything on Chicano Latino Affairs Council. Is that something that is going to be coming forward? I don't know if you folks want more computers, more technology, or whatever, but there's a separate series of requests so that they're not sprinkled all through all these agency requests, but one request was sent by through the governor's office on the Office of Technology, in which we're breaking down them, but there wasn't anything for your council. Is that something that you anticipate is going to be still forthcoming to us?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. The council did not request any funds from the Office of Enterprise and Technology. Currently, the council has updated its computer software and systems, and we're up and running. We just need more manpower, and that's what we're going to engage in the next legislative session or the next year.
Okay, I see. Thank you. Any questions on the council? Mr. Munoz. Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Munoz. Appreciate it. And then as soon as we can shut down the PowerPoint, the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, we have a packet that they provided to us, and also they did submit a technology request, and that's a separate two-page document that the members should have at your in front of you on what their technology requests are.
I'm sure that one will be better.
Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eileen Herr, and I'm the Executive Director for the State Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. And I have with me Mr. Adil Lowry, past board chair, and also now currently a member of the board. Here with me, and so it's a great pleasure to sit before you today and for the first time in 6 years to talk about additional funding for the councils, particularly for our council, that in the last three past bienniums our budgets have been frozen, and it's something that we've been glad to do as part of the state's response to the state's budget deficit, but now that we're in the surplus, we're very glad that there is a sort of a lookout for the councils and the smaller state agencies. And so I passed out to you three items, well, actually four items. One, the little blue sheet is just a little two-pager about our buy-in report, just summary for you all, followed with some demographics of census 2000. And then you'll see a little target icon in front, our strategic plan, which we did in the last biennium, which helped us to look at our priorities in light of the limited budget that we had so that we can be effective in our services. And then you'll see this A Community of Contrast, which is a national report that we were able to be a part of, looking at 10 emerging cities where there were large population of Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and looking at each area, the demographics, the issues, the policies, and making recommendations. So all of this is part of my report to the legislature about the activities that the council has undertaken in the last 2 years. And one is that we've tried to do much on the local and state level, but we've also tried to bring our issues to the national level. We're going to now refer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hurd, I noticed on this sheet of paper that your numbers are from the 2000 census, which, you know, by this time is not very helpful. but the numbers that are in the appendices in this document, are they more updated than 2000?
Ms. Hurd?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, the what you see in here in the appendix, this is actually from the P4, which is the sample, which came out in about 2004, 2005. This one we did right away when the census data came out, and I wanted to show you this so that you could get a look at the pie chart in terms of the ethnicity and the ethnic makeup of the Asian Pacific population here in Minnesota. It still holds true even though the numbers have increased slightly. And I thought this would be useful in anticipation of some of your questions in that who are the Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and that you'll see here that about 27% of all Asian Minnesotans are Hmong, and followed by, you know, we have a very diverse group of Asian Pacifics in Minnesota. Not one group is a majority, over 50%, but we've got good numbers all over. And then if you flip to the second page, a map of the state of Minnesota showing where the concentration of Asians are in Minnesota. And as you can see here, we're spread out throughout the state. Although 80% of the API, Asian Pacific Islander population, is in the metropolitan area, we see growing numbers in rural cities, which I've been very, very fortunate to be able to go and to visit those communities and see how they're doing and how they're thriving, and looking at some of their issues and trying to work with them to have a voice.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rust.
I would just echo Senator Roebling's comment and interest that just providing the information for Minneapolis and St. Paul is we need more than that, and particularly in the interest in the growth of Latino community in the suburbs and also of the Asian Pacific Islanders. It would be of great interest to us, and we get some of that information from our school districts, and I would just recommend that please don't lump us with the urban core as we try to understand the needs and services that our suburban communities need to be aware of with regard to increased immigrant population or whatever else. If we are vitally interested in that, and it's not helpful to know just the statistics about Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator, sure. I did want to provide this to you because it compared the cities of St. Paul, Minneapolis metro area with other similar metro areas in the state. And so in here, it does have, by counties, demographic and issues. And so I wanted to provide this as a resource for you. And I would be more than happy to provide more detailed information.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not saying that this is not of interest. It just doesn't go far enough.
Yes.
There are many of us who would prefer more detailed information about our communities, where we are witnessing tremendous growth.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator, I would be more than happy to follow up with you and to provide
you that
piece of information.
Well, in fact, on page 32, it does list concentration. What let's switch the date on this. But it says like Falcon Heights, Lauderdale, St. Paul, Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, Hopkins, Richfield. So
good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's the kind of information I'm interested in. Although that's also 2000.
Yes.
And things are vastly different in the last 6 years, I would maintain.
Chair, yes. Ms. Herr.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I wanted to go back to this blue two-pager that I provided for you. I just wanted to talk a little bit about that. You are correct that since Census 2000 to right now, the Census Bureau in August of 2005 did come up with new population estimates that placed Asian Pacific Minnesotans at 204, or now making about 4% of the state's population. So that has increased from the 2000 census of putting the population at 180,000. So that number has grown. And so we do rely on the census data, but as time goes on, their economic data lags behind just the population data. So wanted to let you know that in 1985, the state legislature did create the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans to do a number of things, but we've broken it down to what we call our mission statement, and that is to be an advisor to policymakers, advocate for the community, and a builder of bridges. And we take those roles as in terms of being an advisor to policymakers. We want to be at your service. We want to work in cooperation with members of the legislature on issues that are important to you and your community that you serve. Many times we have worked with specific senators to work on specific bills that would best serve their constituents, and that's a service that we provide, and we want to let you know and say that we are available, and we want to be more effective in that. Two is that we want to be an advocate for the community. We are the institutional voice within state government for the Asian Pacific American community. That's something that they felt was lagging, and they wanted that representation or that voice within state government, and we are very happy to be that voice. And the third part is to be a builder of bridges, and that is that we want to broker relationship between the Asian Pacific community and the non-Asian Pacific community, between Asian ethnic groups and one another, for greater understanding, greater unity, and greater purpose. Here we have some key highlights, but I wanted to focus on the major issues facing the community right now. We've, with the work of the board, have identified three main priorities. One, and I want to start first off, is that I love working with the Asian Pacific community. There's lots of successes, lots of growth, lots of good stories that I can share with you. Many, many great things. But then there are also areas that we need to work on to improve, to do a better job. And those are in three areas. One, economic disparities. Right now, access to wealth and wealth creation. We want to be a part of that, the Asian Pacific community. We want to be a part of the American dream. How do we make that real for us? We are very aware that the state has a disadvantaged business enterprise program. We've heard from our businesses that they are not able to compete or to be certified to partake of this in this program. And that is a concern to us, in that if we are to share part of the pie, we want to be at the table and to know about it. So as you can see here, the last time that we seriously looked at this issue was in 2000, and at that, and this is the last data that I could find on the participation of minorities in the state's procurement program. And at that time, the state had a $2.2 billion procurement program. But of that, only 1.6 or 36 million went to minority businesses. The state has a goal that they want to enforce. And we asked, and we want to look at, is the state utilizing its program? Is it getting to the community? And we're hearing from the community business owners that that is not the case. I want to talk a little about educational disparities. I was a part of the Mind the Gap, the Itasca project, which found a direct link between income and educational attainment rates. The higher your educational attainment rate, the greater your income. A great disparity that really alarmed me was that in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, 33% of its residents had bachelor degrees or higher, but only 19% African American, 11% Mexican, and only 8% of Hmong had college degrees or higher. That is a disparity. We want to work more. We want to do a better job. Additionally, not in here, but in the ITASC, in the Mind the Gap report, there was a finding that about 90% of Twin Cities residents had a high school diploma, but for the Hmong community and refugees communities, that number was less than 50%. And just by having a high school degree greatly increases your chance of getting a better paying job.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Roblin.
Thank you. I'm wondering, since that number probably reflects all ages of the population, how have you any statistics to show how the younger group of the population is doing? What's the graduation rate, for example, in the Twin Cities of Asian Americans? Do you have any statistics on that?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator, I have the dropout rate for St. Paul and Minneapolis at around 14% for Asian students, the dropout rate. So that means that our graduation rates are lower than the average as to what I was able to ascertain. I think it's about 8 to 9% of all Minnesota students go on to graduate. So or have a dropout rate. The dropout rate for all students is 8%. And out of that, Asian students is 14%. But then here's the great disparity, too, is that when you compare the Asian dropout rate to, and we, I don't want to say it's a good story, but I think that is the better dropout rate of all minority students. So people overlook us. Oh, the Asian students are doing well when you compare that to African-American dropout rate, Native American dropout rate at 85% to 90% dropout rate, and then Hispanic dropout rate at 25 to 35%. And then here's the Asian at only 14. They're doing okay. They're not doing that bad. But the fact is that there is a disparity there, and we do want to reach out. And the alarming fact for me, too, is that the median age of Asian community is 22 years old. For Hmong community is 16 years old. And so if that's the rate, you know, it is an alarming issue, particularly when most of our population is within that graduating age of, or high school age.
Thank you.
Senator Lumber.
Do we know what a white Caucasian dropout rate is?
Yes.
You know what? I do not have that in front of me. I'm going to have to rely on Senator Pappas, who is the education guru and our partner in crime on this issue many times in the past.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I think it's about 5% because we graduate about 95%. Right?
Good to know. Ms. Herr, anything further? Sarah Pappas?
I wanted to wait for Ms. Herr to finish her presentation.
Oh, sure. Okay.
If she's not finished.
Sure. And then I wanted to just draw attention to the last point, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, about the citizenship and voting gap that exists within the Asian Pacific community. We hear about the American dream, but a big part of that is to be engaged in the democratic process. And what we see from our data and the statistics is that for the Asian Pacific community, the majority of us are foreign-born and have yet to go through the process of naturalization. You have to be naturalized, and then you have to register to vote, and then you have to actually go out and vote. And earlier you were talking about the voting rate of Chicano Latinos. Here, for the Asian American rate, I would have to say the rate is low, and we can do much better in that the statistics that I provided for you, 40% of all foreign-born are naturalized, and that 40, 43% spans all age range. So when you look at 18 and over that can vote, that can register to vote, actually, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And at a national level, the Asian Pacific Islander American Vote Initiative, they were able to speculate that in Minnesota alone, the percentage of Asians that are voting is less than 12%. And so I want to maximize it. I want to go to 100%. And so there's a lot of work to be done with regards to civic engagement, citizenship drive, naturalization drive, voter education, and then actually getting out the vote. And then on, if you flip it, the Biennium Work Plan lists some things that we are going to do. One is that we do want to strengthen internally. We want to have a strong board. We want to have strong staff. We want to be able to have the things that are necessary for us to do our business before we can even start responding to the needs of the community. And over the past biennium, we have been hindered a little bit by budget constraints in that we had to spend so much of our time and energy. And I always say that we are advisors working in the policy development arena. We are not professional fundraisers. We don't have any fundraisers on our staff to be raising those funds. So now we want to be able to focus on strengthening ourselves internally so that we can respond to the community, and that you can see there's four bullet points, four priorities, areas in which we hope to be spending the next 2 years doing some work and trying to bring solutions to these difficult areas. So,
thank you, Sarah.
I'm done. Thank you.
I did, Mr. Chairman. I know Ms. Herr and all the staff and the board members are very hardworking, and I served on the council myself for a while. But I did want to ask a question about your board membership. It's a very, very diverse group, but I noticed that there's no one from the Hmong community on the board. And is this, you know, the governor does the appointments. If you brought this to the governor's attention, that considering that's 26% of the Asian Pacific community, you should have Hmong representation on your board.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, you bring up a very, very good point, and it's something that we've talked to the governor for the last 2-3 appointment sessions about. But for him, there's not enough good candidates. There's not enough qualified candidates. I want 2 or 3 that I can choose from. And so we are hindered by his not appointing people to our board. And I don't know what the reason is. The Hmong community is really upset about that. They've taken it to him. And to this date, I think it's been an ongoing issue, but to this date, since our last Hmong board member's term expired, no one from the Hmong community has been appointed. We have a couple that are not represented to, like the Lao community. Mm-hmm. That is significant, but there's no representation. So mm-hmm. that is an issue that we have brought to the governor's attention, to his office, but we are hindered by him because he does the appointment.
Right.
I noticed the Senate appointees in your 2004 were Senator Anderson and Senator Pariseau. Are those still your members, or have they been changed since?
They reappointed.
Senator, Mr. Chair, they still currently are. I think you are going to appoint new ones, or maybe in the process of appointing new one. But we have had the great pleasure of working with Senator Pariseau and Senator Anderson. They've taken many pieces of legislation for us and worked on very, very important issues, particularly Senator Anderson with workforce development, job training, mm-hmm. and then Senator Pariseau carrying forward social work, mental health legislation for us. And so we very much value and use our legislative members on our board to help us our way through this legislative process.
I do know this was done in 2004, but one of the problems of using legislators is that it almost looks dated. You've got Representative Trimble, and I think he's been gone for, about 8 years.
It's an old picture.
Yeah.
So. Mr. Chair, that was such a great picture of really engagement, and so I had to use it.
But, folks, they do forget about us after a while, you know, so be careful. Any questions of this one? Of this, Ms. Herr? Ms. Herr, I do want to call your attention. We've got a copy of the IT request here, and I do want to call members' attention to it on what would be the third page, page 41 of 284 of the booklet. It says, are the cost estimates for this project reasonable? And this response provided by the Office of Technology says total cost may be too conservative. And then if you look at the last page, they have some overall comments on this council's computer requests. The consequences of this initiative, if not approved, are dire. They are on the edge of the cliff. They don't have the expertise in-house. Server crashed a year ago, don't have a backup. It sounds pretty bad. Could you describe what your situation is like? This is what the experts say about your situation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is something that they wrote up, and so we're very happy that they heard us.
I understand. You didn't write that.
But to be very honest with you, we had to prioritize our budget spending. In the last couple of sessions, our budget was really cut down by 30%. And so we, in order to do our work, I put it into staff and to the community. That meant in the last 6 years, no computers. In the last 6 years, really not a lot of upgrade. So we're really ancient. Our technology, we just, you know, keep fingers crossed that the computer works when we turn it on, or that we don't get a virus that, you know, we have to go out and spend money to get new stuff to clean it up. And so we are very, very hopeful of this initiative. And for us to, in the past, to have that in the budget and to compete with larger state agencies, we would have not fared very well. But I think with the OT small agency budget initiative, that gives us a chance. And we're very happy for that. And we're glad that they heard us. We do want, and we do know right now, that technology is probably the best way for us to reach our statewide audience. But we've not had the expertise or the funding to be able to do that and to do it effectively. And so with the funding under this initiative, and we, again, it was conservative because we don't know what we need. And so we just put it out there. We need 5 new computers, our server, website design, all this stuff. We put it together, and it's a very conservative number. But we're hoping to work with OET to get a start on it, to understand our situation, what we need, and again, very hopeful that we'll be able to utilize this present day and age technology and what's out there.
Thank you. Any further questions, Ms. Herr?
I would also like you all, Mr. Chair, to hear from Adil Lari, our past board member, chair.
If we could do so briefly, okay, because we still have one more council to get to today. So.
Very fast.
Please identify yourself.
My name is Adil Lari. I'm the liaison to the Council of Asian Pacific Minnesotan. Governor decided not to appoint me this cycle. As far as the board membership is concerned, we are authorized to have 19 members. At the present time, we have only 12 members. So we have a number of vacancies, and a lot of other communities would like to be represented as well. As far as budget is concerned, I just want to point out that the over the last few years, the staff has taken a leaf without pay to balance our budget. The council has waived its per diem for the last 3-4 years. They raised their own money for all the refreshments and all that at our board meetings. So just want to just point out that, you know, we try to work in within our budgets and try to live with it.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Well, thank you, Ms. Herr. And as I say, we'll be looking at putting together our budget bill very soon, and we'll be considering what you've told us here. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank members you. Of the committee.
Thank you. And the last council we'll be hearing from today is the Indian Affairs Council.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Anna Marie Hill, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota American Indian Affairs Council. Newly hired in June of this year, I replaced the previous director, Joe Day, who was there for some time, I understand, before my hiring to the department. With me is Mr. Jim Jones. He is our Cultural Resources Director, and he will be discussing a very important and crucial area, graves protections within our department, and another new staff hire, my Legislative and Communications Director, Jolynn Shoptease. So thank you for having us today. I've just prepared a brief testimony. As I stated, I'm new to the council since June of this year, and I don't have any fancy documentation to give you right now, but I do want to point out that we're currently in a website revision. So one of the needs that we identified, or I identified fairly early on, is that acting as a liaison for the Minnesota tribes to the state government, and having a website that was sufficient to give all the information that we need was a very important part of our office. So we are going in through that revision, updating all our demographics to the best that we can, and any information that we have, and will be available to you shortly.
We've just received, just passed out a copy of the strategic information. Apparently, this is what the offices of technology has determined you're currently spending, but we don't know whether that means there should be more. We don't know what these numbers mean. It just, this is what you're spending.
They mean just the budget numbers.
Okay, right.
In reference, yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
And you do have the agency profile in front of you.
Yes.
That was prepared for this year.
Right.
Okay.
In our budget books. Yes.
Yep. We are, Indian Affairs Council, as many of you may know, is the oldest council of all the councils that you've heard today. We were established in 1963, and as a matter of fact, the first in the nation to have an Indian Affairs Council. So we've been around for a very, very long time. We have quite a large board. We have all 11 tribal chairs or their designees, our voting members to the board. We have two at-large members, meaning those members who are also voting members represent out-state tribes. We have an urban advisory council to the board, which consists of six members. And we also have ex officio members and a member appointed by the governor. Now that size of the ex officio board is a board of 13. Our newest additions to the board were the Department of Transportation and the Department of Administration. We also have three appointed members from the Senate and three appointed members from the House. We get together quarterly for meetings. That's where we generate the majority of our business.
Who are the Senate appointees?
We do not have them yet.
Oh, well, who served on the past?
Who were in the past?
Yeah.
The Senate. Senator Lori.
Senator.
You know, it escapes me. I'm
okay.
Sorry. So,
sure.
But Senator Lori. Oh, Senator Rood.
Okay.
And then another one escaped. Senator Vickman.
Hmm. Okay.
I apologize.
Sure.
We have a large board. We do meet quarterly, and that's where, again, we generate a lot of our business and a lot of the work that we do throughout the year. The primary purpose, as you know, is to serve as the official liaison between the state of Minnesota and the 11 tribal governments and the American Indian communities. We advise the state government on issues of concern to Indian tribes and the American Indian communities. And we also have a very large role in graves protection or cultural resources, which Mr. Jones will speak to in just a minute. And that is covered under an entirely different statute and with federal law as well. We serve all 11 tribes. We serve the entire enrolled membership for the state of Minnesota and with their
the community members and those that reside outside of the state of Minnesota. I'm sorry, my throat is not handling this very well, so I apologize for that. Some of our core functions are that we work with various state agencies, appointed liaisons, and American Indian constituents in the state. We've also had a long-time federal grant that has been issued to our department in the amount of $60,000 to work with grant oversights with the tribes. So we monitor state laws as well as monitoring federal laws with regard to American Indian human remains and the burial items. And we also provide quite a vehicle for the urban Indian constituent population here in the state of Minnesota. We have two offices currently. We employ a total of four staff people, three who are with me. The additional fourth is our fiscal agent and our business manager. And our budget consists of $470,000, $75,000 approximately per year, $950,000 per biennium. And that is just to mainly staff the individuals who have expertise in all the areas that we work in and to have our quarterly meetings and to do the business of Indian Affairs Council with the state and the tribes, and manage two small offices, one in the Bemidji rural area and one in St. Paul, and to handle mainly board functions. So, but at this time, it's very important that you hear from our Cultural Resources Director, if there would be identified as an additional need for in our department. Oh, thank you very much. That's where it would, I have identified that that's where it would be, and his Jim Jones.
Yeah, so. Before you do that, let me ask a question. And members, I'm looking at page 4 of the agency overview. I notice it lists expenditures by category, and it says total compensation, so this mm-hmm. is what, and then it says other operating expenses. And then fiscal year 2006 is $154,000. Then it jumped up to $401,000 for 07, which is $250,000. Then it drops back down for 08 to $158,000, 09, $178,000. So there was kind of a spike for the fiscal year 07. I don't see any explanation as to what caused that to happen. Is there?
Our executive budget officer, who has been assisting me in handling all the financial aspect, is here, so she can speak.
I'm sure there's
an
explanation. I just don't see what it is.
Mr. Chair, again for the record, my name is Peggy Lexo. What you see there is a representation of. I think there was some lag time from when. Ms. Hill was hired as the executive director, so they had quite a large amount of carry forward from one year to the other. And what this represents is, and Mr. Jones hasn't had a chance to go into the cultural resources mm-hmm. program, but most of what they would like to do with that carry forward in this the rest of this year is to put it toward that cultural resources program. So that's why you see that big difference.
And would that all have to be spent in the current fiscal mm-hmm. year by June 30th, then?
Okay. Under current law, they have to spend that by the end of the year, or it would cancel back to the general fund.
Sure. Okay. Mr. Jones, did you wish to address the division?
Yes, again, my name is Jim Jones, Cultural Resource Director for the Indian Affairs Council. I oversee the protection of cemetery sites for American Indian remains across the state. I have been in the position since 1995, and also, I work primarily under Minnesota Statute 307.08, which is the Private Cemeteries Act, which mandates the protection of all human remains throughout the state of Minnesota. I've been actively involved in archaeology and cultural resource work for over 20 years now. In the last 10 years, our agency has been dealing with remains that have been unearthed throughout the state of Minnesota. And remains that have been transferred over to the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council prior to enactment of a federal law that was passed in 1990. That federal law was the Native American Graves Protection Repatriation Act, which was a federal law that mandated any institution receiving federal dollars inventory and make a detailed inventory of all collections that they had in their possession of any human remains or associated grave goods or funerary objects, such as items that were buried with a person at the time that they were deceased. Prior to that law, 1 year prior to that law, under our state law, University of Minnesota, the Science Museum of Minnesota, Minnesota Historical Society, as well as private institutions throughout the state, transferred all legal custody of their possessions, remains, over to the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. So in 1990, when that law was passed, that responsibility under that federal law fell on the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council and, in a sense, the state of Minnesota. Because the state receives federal dollars, we were treated as an institution. Since 1985, the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, working with early appropriations from the state, started a Minnesota reburial program, and we have been systematically reburying remains throughout the state of Minnesota. When that law was passed, it mandated that you had to have a detailed inventory of all remains that you had in your collections by November 15, 1995. I came on board in January of 1995, found out that we were out of compliance with the federal law. We had to comply. At that point, we requested a NAGPRA grant in the amount of $72,000 from the National Park Service to detail and inventory everything we had in our collection. At that point, we inventoried over 2,000 remains that we still had in our control, remains that were transferred to the Indian Affairs Council under that state law. Since 1995, we have been systematically repatriating these remains according to both state and federal law. However, in the last few years, when we get one collection returned or reburied, two or three collections come back to the council under accidental unearthings throughout the state. And an example of that would be a construction project in Detroit Lakes, for instance, where a homeowner is building a house. During the construction of the foundation, unearthed remains that turns out to be 4,000 to 5,000 years old. Artifacts were associated and found with these remains, but that one burial site yielded 17 individuals. These landowners have been sitting there for 2 years waiting to do something with this property and have been put on hold because we have been responding to recovering these remains. 1 week later, that was in April 29th, we had another call from Waukon, McGregor, Minnesota, where another homeowner digging, again, a foundation, had unearthed remains. That one was a more recent cemetery that dated back to the 1800s and was more than likely related to the fur trade era. But that one was historic Ojibwe coffin burials, historic burials. And when we identified the site, we identified five coffins that were impacted. After we got done with the analysis and further testing, we found that there was additional 17 other graves that were still intact on that property. That landowner was not allowed to build on that site because basically they had coffin burials still underneath the proposed foundation. It wasn't until this last year that the state archaeologists defined the boundaries of that cemetery site so that those landowners could go ahead and proceed building, even though they settled with their insurance company within the last 2 years. Those are cases that we've been dealing with. So the last repatriation we've done, large one, was probably back in 1990. At that point, we returned 1,068 remains back to the Sisseton Sioux tribe in South Dakota. These are the remains that were found and documented throughout Minnesota. In 1998, we repatriated 338 remains to the same Dakota communities and these were remains that were identified as historic Dakota remains that were returned back to that tribe. Now, we have in our collection, as of today, maybe 350 to 400 remains that are left in our inventory that we have. But we have been dealing with accidental unearthings for the last few years.
And it strikes me that the developing areas are probably going to keep finding them, I think. Mm-hmm. Senator Robling's district, Senator Jungbauer, Senator Olsen. The high school I went to on Nicollet Island, and Senator Pogemiller was 1 year behind me, and they a few years ago were trying to expand, and guess what they ran into when they started digging, you know? So they found
Phyllis
some...
Phyllis Kahn.
That's on tape.
Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jones, you know, there's a group out in the western part of the state that would like to take a look at the Wood Lake battlefield and do something to commemorate the loss of the Dakota people there. Would you be a resource for that kind of thing? Or, you know, I guess I'm not sure, you know, who might serve as some kind of a resource person that would have some expertise in that kind of an issue.
Yes, I would be a contact. Not only dealing with cemetery sites, but I also deal with archaeological sites throughout the state when they relate to American Indian history. So in that regard, I would definitely be a resource.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Sarah Robling?
When they do unearth remains and the property owner can't do with their property what they had anticipated, I mean, they probably very unknowingly purchased the site that had burial sites on it. Is there some way that they are compensated, or did they have to just wait a long time and they still can do some development there? Because I'm thinking if people hear that they can't do what they want with their property and they uncover some remains, are they even going to report it if they think that their property becomes useless to them then?
That's a very good point, Chairman and Senator. One of the issues that we're dealing with...
Jones, yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
One of the issues that we're dealing with and we want to address is this coming year, clarify changes in the law in the Minnesota Statute 307, the Private Cemeteries Act, to encourage landowners to come forward. And one avenue may be is to offer those citizens a tax break on their property, especially when this property is on a lakeshore development where they can't utilize that property. On the cases where these landowners weren't able to build, 90% of the time we have worked with these landowners to come up with a solution so that the remains and the development can coexist. And that's where our office is involved. But due to budget restraints, we cannot deal with the recoveries fast enough because it's just me in the office. And the cases that we dealt with in the last couple of years were done with volunteers, people that came in on a weekend, or students even, that were helping with the recovery of these remains. The landowners in Detroit Lakes may proceed to build, but at this point, they're afraid to, because they're afraid of what else is out there on that property. If there's 17 remains on this property, they're thinking that there's a lot more burials on that property. Under 307 currently, the law defines efforts should be made by the state to purchase large cemetery sites. However, the effort does not give any appropriation for purchasing cemetery sites. And the last time that the council, through the state, received any funding for an appropriation for purchasing a burial site was back in 1984. You know, we're looking at, in cooperation with the State Archaeologist's Office and Department of Administration, on defining language that would give a homeowner a tax break on that property. But in order to do that, they have to have that property surveyed by a licensed surveyor, because then it becomes a platted cemetery under 307. And then it gets removed by the tax records by the county, because now it's a defined platted cemetery. But on remains that were found, such as the case in Detroit Lakes or even in McGregor, those were unknown burial sites. They were unplatted burial sites. They were unknown because there was no documentation like we have from the 1800s that lists all of the mounds that were mapped throughout the state. These two sites were unplatted. There was no way of knowing that these were burial sites until the remains were hit. You know, so we're working at in cooperation with the Historical Society, DNR, the State Archaeologist's Office on helping come to solutions so that you encourage a landowner to come forward to say, this is what it's on my property, to identify the site. Then our office works with that developer, that landowner, to come to a solution that they could still utilize their property but yet protect the burial site that may be on it.
Okay. So we'll see.
Just briefly, but you had mentioned something earlier about it. They were waiting for an insurance settlement.
The case in McGregor, Minnesota, they had received a partial payment for the loss of their cabin that had burnt down the previous year. And they were waiting for the rest of the settlement to finish building their replacement cabin. And because of the remains that were found, that got put on hold. Because they had remains literally sticking out of their foundation of their proposed new house. And because once we identified other graves in there, we literally had people that would have been still underneath the house cabin, the house foundation. So it wasn't feasible. We had to then decide where the proposed new septic system was going to go in, define the boundaries of the lots with the setbacks and everything, and then looking at where utilities would come into this lot and come into this new residence. They were waiting for this to continue on so that they could receive the additional money for the settlement for the insurance loss that they had. The cabin burnt down in October the previous year. And so that was associated with it. Now, in a sense, since then, they've been, I believe, talking to an adjacent landowner on selling their property to that adjacent landowner, because for a year and a half, they were told it was not probably feasible that they could build on that lot because the lot size was so small and everything else regarding those setbacks would probably not allow it.
Anything further? Okay, members, on thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Wednesday we're going to be looking at the Lottery Commission, the Gambling Control Board, the Racing Commission, so we'll be examining those budget areas. And to our committee minister, Kathleen Lonergan, happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Meeting adjourned.
Trying to sing?
No.